Good morning, I'm Ali Velshi. It's Saturday, January the 28th. Another morning in America reporting on video footage of a brutal attack at the hands, the fists, the feet, the batons of police officers, leading to the unnecessary death of a black man. Whatever his alleged crime, and there is no clarity around that issue at all, Tyre Nichols died after a brutal beating by police. There was no trial. There was no conviction by a jury of his peers. There was no sentence imposed by a judge. Just a beating and a death. Last night, the Memphis Police Department released four videos from January 7th, the night the 29-year-old Tyre Nichols was stopped by police and beaten by five officers. Nichols was hospitalized in critical condition. He died 3 days later. The five officers involved were arrested on Thursday. They were charged with second-degree murder, one count of aggravated assault, two counts of aggravated kidnapping, two counts of official misconduct, and one count of official oppression. I want to be clear, what led to those charges and what you're about to see is a lynching caught on camera in America in 2023. And I do need to warn you, this video is graphic and it is upsetting. The first body camera footage shows Tyre Nichols' first encounter with police. He's stopped at an intersection. An officer is seen opening Nichols' car door, pulling him out violently and urgently. You can hear Nichols say, "I didn't do anything." Look at the bottom left of your screen. A taser comes out, and now things are about to go horribly wrong. Tyre Nichols runs away. Now, what's striking about that first video is that the officer began the encounter hot, using force immediately. In the beginning, Nichols himself seems to be the one who's trying to keep the situation calm. The next videos pick up at a second location where another group of police officers stopped Nichols again. This footage was captured from a security camera that was mounted on a pole. There's no audio to this. It shows the group of officers assaulting Tyre Nichols, kicking him, hitting him, and wielding what appears to be a baton. At one point, it is five police officers against one. Remember, Tyre Nichols weighed about 140 pounds. This third video is arguably the most disturbing. It shows the assault from one of the officers' body-worn cameras. Again, I have to warn you, this is incredibly graphic and difficult to watch and hear.
Give me a mother hands! Watch out! I'm a baton of he the f*** is! He the f***! Watch out! Watch out! Give us your hands! Give us your hands! Give us your hands!
Same location. Ross and Kelsey, okay? Ross and Kelsey, okay?
Watch out! Give me your f***!
Now, this next piece of video, you don't actually have to watch. You just have to listen. If you're a mother or a parent, this audio is going to sting. When those officers were beating Tyre Nichols, a beating that he would die from, he was just about 100 yards away from his own home. He was so close that he called out to his mother.
You might get sprayed again.
Hey,
Mike, get in here, bro. Watch out. Mom!
Initially, before this video was made public, the Memphis Police Department claimed that Tyre Nichols was stopped because police suspected him of driving recklessly. But the Memphis Police Chief, C.J. Davis, said early Friday morning that an investigation and review of the footage found, quote, no proof of reckless driving. She told NBC News the department is still unable to find evidence as to why Nichols was pulled over in the first place. There are contradictions in the video itself as well. NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton made the point last night with Chris Hayes while doing her best to hold back tears after watching this brutal video with the rest of the nation.
You hear at points officers in the video say, show me your hands, show me your hands. But they're holding Tyree Nichols' arms and they're kicking him. Yep. It's impossible for him to show his hand. The minutes felt so long as I was watching it.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've been covering this all day, and I thought I could get through the whole day without getting emotional about it, but it felt like forever before anyone seemed to realize the gravity of what had happened to this guy.
Let's talk for a moment about Tyree Nichols. He loved to watch the sunset. He loved taking pictures of the sunset. He loved to skateboard. He had been devoted to the sport since he was a young boy. He started teaching his four-year-old son. His mother, Rovon Wells, expressed with great pride how inherently good her son was.
My son. My son. I know everybody say they, mother say they had a good son. Everybody's son is good, but my son, he actually was a good boy. My son was a beautiful soul, and he touched everyone.
Tyree Nichols and his stepfather, Rodney Wells, were very close. Mr. Wells said himself, quote, I was Tyree's stepfather, but you can take the step out of it because that was my son. They worked together at FedEx on the same shift. They followed a daily routine, created a tradition of sorts, not just Tyree and his stepfather, but his mother, too. As attorney Ben Crump explained, Tyree and his stepfather took a meal break together at the same time every day. His mother, at home where they all lived, would prepare a meal and wait for them to come home. Now, every day at the same time, she will be waiting, waiting for her son and her husband to walk through the door. But only one of them will appear. Rovon has not brought herself to watch the video yet. That's according to Mr. Crump. His father, Rodney, explained what it was like hearing his son's final words.
He was calling for his mother, which made me break down because, as I said, it was right around the corner from my house. And for him to be that close and not make it, and then this horrific thing happened, it was very difficult.
Joining me now from Memphis is NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton. Antonia, we played that clip of you from last night. These stories are tough, so thank you for your coverage of it. In the morning after these videos were released, what does the city of Memphis look and feel like?
It's somber, and I can tell you what I saw, you know, into the late evening last night was a city that was in shell shock. People who were protesting were really peaceful, and they were really trying to not just honor Tyree Nichols and his family, but support each other. There were small groups of people at times watching the video together, asking each other questions, saying, you know, are you essentially seeing what I'm seeing? And it seemed like it was weighing heavily on people, but a lot of folks were at a loss for words. The protests at many points were really quiet, which I thought was a reflection of just the immense grief. And of course, the history here, you know, a city as historic as Memphis, the pain that the Black community here feels, that they've been here before. And all of that was in the air last night. I think as people kind of come out of that fog and they get a better look at or understanding at what we see in about an hour of this footage, there are going to be a lot of questions about the timeline and about the nature of this unit that these five officers were on, the Scorpion unit. When I say timeline, I mean, you brought it up yourself. The beginning of this, we see no evidence of a crime committed by Tyree Nichols. We see no evidence of reckless driving, at least with what we've been presented with so far. And then you didn't show it, but if people have the stomach to watch, and I'll warn folks at home, you might not want to, toward the end, There's a long gap before anyone renders him aid. Mm-hmm. And you see additional people arrive on the scene and they stand around and he is slumped up on a car, very clearly in physical and emotional anguish, very much in need of first aid assistance. And they are very slow. About 20 or so minutes goes by before he's really given aid. And that was really one of the most, that was ultimately what had me feeling so emotional last night. It was just not being able to wrap my mind around that piece. And it opens up those questions of who else was on the scene. We now know from the county sheriff's department that two deputies involved have been relieved of their duties pending an investigation. And I think you're going to hear community members today push for more of that. They want to understand more of how it was possible that people would wait this long, how a traffic stop becomes an execution. And they're going to want to know more about the nature of these police officers' trainings, their histories in this department. And I think that's sort of the next route we're going to see all of this go. Certainly the calls for reform here are going to continue. Even after what we saw last night was peaceful, it was calm. There's a lot of hurt and anger here, Allie.
In that video that you referenced of no one rendering Tyre Nichols aid, there's actually off to the side, you see two cops sort of fist bumping each other. That was particularly hard to watch. Let me ask you about the idea of the Memphis police chief, very much like Minnesota after the killing of George Floyd. The police are not behind these officers, which is a sea change in the way these things happen. It makes it easier to have a trial. It makes it easier to get a conviction when the police and the police chief and experts in the police force are able to say, this is not how we train our police, or this is not what they were supposed to be doing.
That's right. And, you know, it's almost strange for me, having covered a bunch of these stories in my career. It's odd to have these folks so available to me and to our teams on the ground here as a reporter. The transparency, their willingness to have press conferences, to answer tough questions, to stay longer, answer questions as they're walking out the door. This is not what covering these stories often feels like. You see the community begging for answers. People wait at times for months for information, months for videos to be released. That's, of course, not what we've seen happen here over the last couple weeks. And while there's gratefulness around that, I've heard community members in particular shout out Chief Davis at MPD. There's also this frustration and anger at the fact that what that tells them is that it could have happened this way in the past, that this could have been the standard all along. Mm-hmm. Why now? And that's a part of the question, of course, now, too. And so you're right. There's been this sort of unprecedented level of access for reporters, of answering questions for the community, and people, I think that's part of why people were able to process the video last night, as they felt like they were respected to some degree by the fact that these five officers are already in custody. They're facing second degree murder charges. That's what everyone in the community told me that they wanted them to face. They're grateful, but they're confused why this hasn't been the standard in recent months and in recent years.
Antonia, thank you so much for your excellent reporting on this. NBC's Antonia Hilton is live in Memphis for us, and we'll, of course, stay very close to her and this story. Joining me now is Sonia Pruitt, retired captain of the Montgomery County Police Department in Maryland. She's a founder of the Black Police Experience. She joined me last night. Captain Pruitt, good morning to you again. Thank you for being with us. You know, last night in our coverage, Karen Bass, the new mayor of Los Angeles, former member of Congress, was on with my colleague Joy Reid, and they were talking about the brutality that we saw in the video last night. I want to play for you how Karen Bass described it.
There's the guardian mentality that's traditional, protect and serve, that often is not done with our communities. Then there's the warrior style of policing. What we saw was the warrior style of policing. But to me, unless there are very specific consequences and the leadership, I don't care how much you train people.
Yeah.
Officers have to know that there will be consequences.
You made a similar point to me last night in which you said training's only as good as what people will actually do. These cops looked and felt and acted like warriors, not protectors and defenders.
Yes. And I also said that policy is only as good as an officer being held accountable to that policy. And then the police culture squashes both of those things, because if you're deeply entrenched enough into police culture, then the policy and the training really does not matter.
Yeah, you made that point to me. And I guess to Antonia's comment, the lawyer, Benjamin Crump, had said, you know, what happened here after the tragedy is the gold standard of how we need to do it. Charge the police, relieve them of their duties, investigate and charge. But how do you change that first part? Right. This will be accountability. It'll actually never be justice, because Tyree Nichols is dead. How do we change that first part? They get training all over this country. I think you were talking about it last night. Everybody trains their police now differently. Why do these young police officers, all of whom were recruited between 2017 and 2020, why do they display behavior that we associate with very old school policing?
Because they are mentored, they are taught. And maybe for some, the draw to policing is this this sense that you will have power. And, you know, I was doing some reading last night and I was reminded of something called distributive justice. Distributive justice is different from legal justice. In distributive justice, officers are on the street distributing their own idea of what justice is. There's no idea of due process because the wheels of due process turn too slowly. And triggering that is the fact that a citizen may not comply. They may not follow your orders, that you cannot control them. Then all of a sudden you're like, well, I can now, and rationalizing it by the police culture and loyalty and how we've always done it, I can now distribute my own justice. And it doesn't even matter if you have charges. As you can see, no one knows why Tyree Nichols was stopped. And there is a part in the video where the dispatcher says, as they're pursuing him, what are the charges? And no one answers,
right?
Because there probably weren't any charges.
Let me ask you very quickly about the idea that the five police officers charged are black and the victim is black. You and I have been talking for 3 years about police violence and police brutality, but in most cases, it's been white police and black victims. What do you glean from what we know about this story?
That is so sad. In our community, we talk about internalized racism, meaning black people who hate their blackness. I'm not sure if that is the case here or whether they were just overwhelmed with the power that they had been given as police officers. But what we do know is that clearly from when you talk to anyone from the black community, that the fact that these five officers were not the vanguards that they were supposed to be for our community, that they were actually destroyers of a young black, to all accounts, very kind young man. It's hard to find the words. This has been sitting on my heart because I have two sons.
Yeah.
They're young. They're slightly built. They're very kind and funny, and everyone loves them. And to think that these black men would not see Tyree Nichols or my son or someone else's son or nephew as a member of their own family, it is just incredibly, incredibly hurtful.
This has been a very hurtful story all around. Sonia Pruitt, thank you, as always. Sonia Pruitt is a retired police captain at the Montgomery County Police Department and the founder of the Black Police Experience. My friend and colleague, Reverend Al Sharpton, is set to deliver the eulogy at Tyree Nichols' funeral on Wednesday. He joins me at the top of the hour to discuss this case. Plus, officials in California have released the body camera footage and the 911 call from the home invasion and attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi. We're going to have the latest in that investigation. But next, more on Memphis. I'm joined by someone whose work on race and criminal justice has made him one of the most frequently consulted experts on race and policing. The former prosecutor, Paul Butler, joins me next. We're following the nationwide outrage over video of Memphis police officers beating Tyree Nichols, leading to his death. Joining me now is Paul Butler. He's a former federal prosecutor and NBC News legal analyst. His work on race and criminal justice has made him one of the most frequently consulted scholars on criminal law and the issues of race in policing. He wrote the book Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Thank you for being with us, Paul. Let me ask you about this issue of a black man dying at the hands of police, but the police all being black. The conversation I was just having with Sonia Pruitt. It becomes about the power relationship which exists in racist policing. What is this? Is this part of racism in policing, or is this a weird power dynamic that comes from toxic policing?
All of the above. One of the ironies of this video is if these officers weren't in uniform and badges, the same thing that happened to Mr. Nichols could have happened to them. That does not mean that they're not as biased as any other officers. Statistically, Black men and women suffer the same kind of threat from Black and Latinx officers as they do from white officers. So it's important that police departments look like the communities that they're supposed to protect and serve. That's a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition of equal justice policing.
Every time you and I have spent a lot of time over the last few years watching videos in which people subsequently die, they're all a little bit different. In South Carolina, Walter Scott was running away from police, and we watched him get shot. Also, contrary to what the police officer said, in Minneapolis, we saw George Floyd's life getting snuffed out. This was unusual in terms of its active violence and the energy that the police had that the victim didn't actually seem to be mirroring. I mean, he was obviously very, very scared with what was going on, but he actually seemed to be the calmest voice in the crowd. What do you think was going on there?
So what the video shows is an American citizen who apparently has done nothing wrong being tortured and executed by armed agents of the state. And afterwards, you see them fist bumping. This is warrior policing on steroids. If you ask these cops what they were doing, they would say their jobs.
Right.
They would say that they want to demonstrate that they're the biggest, toughest, baddest crew on the street. And Mr. Nichols sealed his fate when he ran. And for 8 minutes, those officers had to chase him. They were going to make him learn that day. One of the officers says that they should kick his ass. They should stomp his ass. And that's exactly what those officers did.
So there are a lot of people who don't fear interactions with police who would say, why would you run if you did nothing wrong? Now, let's just point out the fact that he ran after he was he had spent several minutes on the ground saying that he's complying with what they're asking for, but it seemed inconsistent. They're saying, get on the ground. He says, I'm on the ground. The video shows that he's on the ground, but they wanted him on the ground in a different way than he was on the ground. They're holding his arms, and yet they want him flat on the ground. So he, at some point, makes the decision to run away. Let's just talk a little bit about why he would have had a fear that would have caused him, to, a 140-pound man, to run away from five armed police.
So what happens is that he stopped for apparently no reason. He says, I didn't do anything wrong. Then they try to yank him out of the car. They tase him. They pepper spray him. They're cursing and screaming at him. He does what I would have done if I was attacked by five armed thugs. I would have run, especially if my mother's house was 100 yards away. And again, they're going to try to make him pay for that. This is, it's as a Black man, it's really hard to think that this could happen in this country. But the reality is that it happens all of the time, especially with these squads. People have pointed out that Mr. Nichols was 145 pounds and suffered from Crohn's disease. When you get arrested in Tennessee, they take your measurements. All five of the officers who were arrested were over 200 pounds. Two of them were college football players. That's part of their qualification for the kind of police work that they do.
We were talking to the attorney general from Minnesota, Keith Ellison, last night about the prosecution of George Floyd. And you'll remember that because you and I covered that a lot together. It was not a slam dunk. It looked like it. People who saw the video say, hey, this is going to be obvious. But it's never obvious, in part because when they were selecting a jury, they asked members of the jury, do you believe in Black Lives Matter? Have you ever experienced racism yourself? With the idea that that kind of thing could be disqualifying. They're going to bring up all sorts of things. Last night, there was reference on the video to the fact that he may have tried to grab the police officer's gun. There was some reference to him maybe being on something on a different network. They're talking about toxicology reports. They tried to do that with George Floyd, right? They tried to convince you that George Floyd died of something else.
Yes.
This is not as obvious as watching that video makes it. It's not that obvious.
The defense is always to blame the victim and to say that the police acted reasonably. I think based on this video, it's very hard to accept that, and it should be hard for a juror. But as you say, every case is different. These are five different officers who are charged. They're going to try to point the finger at each other. As you say, they're going to say, well, we didn't kill Mr. Nichols. He died of some other cause. And all the prosecution needs is one juror to go with them. Jurors are often sympathetic to the police, but we have to give the Movement for Black Lives credit because it's responsible for these officers being fired so quickly. It's responsible for the fact that they're criminal prosecutions. It's responsible for the fact that there weren't violent protests last night because what the violence is usually about is getting officers charged. And because of the success of the movement, these officers were charged.
But one thing Keith Ellison said last night is because of the success of the movement, everyone sees these videos now, which in jury selection can be seen as prejudicial.
It may be seen as prejudicial, but you wouldn't want a juror who didn't respond to this video with human empathy. That doesn't mean that they can't put aside their emotion and judge the case fairly.
Paul, thank you for your help in analyzing this. We always appreciate it. And I'm sorry that it's always about things like this. Paul Butler is a professor at Georgetown School of Law. He's an NBC News legal analyst and a former federal prosecutor. He's also the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. We'll have more from Memphis coming up in just a bit. But up ahead, we're going to head overseas where Russia continues its brutal barrage on Ukrainian civilians. We'll have the latest on the war in Ukraine after this. You probably know John Quincy Adams as America's sixth president and also the son of John Adams, the second president. But John Quincy Adams also made history as America's first recognized ambassador, or minister as it was then known, to the Russian Empire. Flash forward to Thursday, when Lynn M. Tracy assumed her post in Moscow as the United States ambassador to the Russian Federation, the first woman to hold that prestigious and perilous position. It comes as relations between Russia and the United States continue to sink to depths not seen since the Soviet Union era, spurred by Russia's barbaric war in Ukraine, which is now in day 339. Following much consternation, Germany now plans to send 14 of these sophisticated Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine while authorizing other European nations to send up to 88 more of them. There was a deal with Russia that if you buy these tanks, you can't pass them to someone else without Germany's explicit permission. Germany has now given that permission. The United States is sending 31 of the advanced Abrams M1 tanks. At the same time, a report in Russian state media says that Russia has acquired 30 T-34 tanks from Laos, which the Soviet Union produced in 1944 and which Laos reportedly received as a gift from Vietnam in the 1980s. Both the Leopard and the Abrams tanks will make a major difference on the battlefront, although they will not be put into battle for several more months, just a logistics matter of getting them there and getting the Ukrainians trained in them. Following the tank announcements, Russia launched another major barrage of missile and self-destructing drone strikes in areas including Kyiv, Zaporizhia, and Odessa. Ukrainian officials say at least 11 people have died. The strikes are a continuation of Russia's strategy of targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure very far from the front, trying to terrorize the Ukrainian citizenry into submission. And it is a strategy that continues not to work. Joining me now is the Admiral James Stavridis. He's the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and NBC News Chief International Security and Diplomacy Analyst. He's the author of several important books, including To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts, and The Crucible of Decision. Admiral, thank you for being here. You are uniquely qualified for the discussion that's taken place. I'd say over the last 3 weeks, there was a real push by the Ukrainians to say something that I paraphrased as, you can't prosecute this war 6 weeks at a time. NATO has to make a decision about what it's prepared to do and then do it now to let the Ukrainians get ahead of this thing, because Russia's a country of almost 150 million people. They can keep sending people to the front. They might be conscripts. They might be who knows what, but they've got people. Tell me what you think has changed in the last couple of weeks.
Well, first of all, good analysis, Sally. We need you in the Pentagon. We need to get ahead of this thing. And I'll give you a perfect example of it. Adding the tanks is going to be just in time supply. In other words, I think we'll get those Leopards certainly. And I think those Abrams will come pretty quickly behind them. The British Challengers are already moving in that direction. That's going to be just in time supply chain, if you will. They'll make a big difference, by the way, because they can be massed. They can crunch through the Russian lines. They can defend against a potential spring offensive from Vladimir Putin. But that's just-in-time scheduling. We need to get ahead of the power curve, and here's where we could do it. It would be getting combat aircraft to the Ukrainians. That's the next big need on the battlefield. The MiG-29s are flown by the Poles. Those would be very good in this role. We could train them to fly the U.S. F-16s. The Ukrainians could learn to fly to that. I think very quickly, that would be an example, your point, of getting ahead, because those tanks are going to be terrific, but they're going to need air cover. And as we saw from the attacks just over the last couple of days, Putin continues to control the skies over Ukraine. So your point is well taken. Let's shine a light on combat aircraft. I think that's the next conversation.
So the hesitance to that, and we've talked about this, you and I, before, because at one point early in the war, almost a year ago, Poland said, we're going to leave a whole bunch of planes on the tarmac. You can come and get them. And the U.S. said, not so fast on this. Part of the issue, and it's the issue that Germany brought up. They said, if we send our tanks in, it'll be proof to Vladimir Putin that this is a Western war. This is a NATO-supported war. I mean, it's not a war from the Ukrainian side that they were invading. But it's that idea that if we escalate, Russia will escalate. And Vladimir Putin does drop this whole nuclear weaponry thing every now and then.
Yeah, and we should not overreact to his nuclear. In my view, it's bluster. He's not going to launch a strategic nuclear attack. He knows that'll lead to the destruction of his nation. Look, I despise Vladimir Putin, but I'll give him this. He loves his country. He is not going to reach for that lever to the apocalypse in a way that's going to cause a nuclear exchange and destroy Russia. Could he use a tactical nuclear weapon? Allie, maybe. But it seems highly unlikely. The international reaction to that would be massive and negative. It would move many of those, if you will, swing votes, India, Pakistan, South Africa, Nigeria, Brazil. It would move them away from Russia. So let's kind of park the nuclear piece of this. I really don't think it's realistic. I think the distinction with fighter aircraft is simply their range. Could they launch and attack targets in Russia, yeah, for example? That would be highly escalatory. I think we could restrain our Ukrainian partners. They would certainly be willing to say, we'll use those inside our borders. I think that's the next argument. And for me, the idea that giving them tanks is escalatory, giving them planes is escalatory, we've kind of passed the point of that discussion, frankly. And I'll close with this. Putin owns this problem. He's the one who invaded. The problem is not, you know, NATO expansion. That's magical thinking. The problem is Vladimir Putin. Aircraft can help the Ukrainians stop it.
Tomas Ilves of Estonia was on with me last week, and he said, why are we worried about whether Russia is going to think that NATO's involved in this war? They invaded another country. At some point, that's the reality. The swing votes you talk about, by the way, the India, the South Africas, who may move if Vladimir Putin did something with nuclear weaponry, are all the people who buy Russia's oil. So it is actually important to them because that's their source of foreign currency. Admiral, thank you, as always. Thank you for your analysis.
Just one final point. We all ought to pause and wish our ambassador to Moscow well. Absolutely. About someone who's serving the country in a vital and important job. And by the way, she follows in the footsteps of former Ambassador Bill Burns to Russia, right, who's now the head of the CIA. Critical job. Very proud of her. Well done. Tough job ahead.
We have to remember, you are also our diplomacy, chief diplomacy analyst. And even in war, diplomacy is one of the most important things. It's often how wars end. So thank you, sir. Admiral James Stavridis is the former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO and NBC News Chief International Security and Diplomacy Analyst. He's the author of To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. Officials in California have released the body camera footage and 911 call from the October attack on then Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul. We'll have the latest on that investigation coming up next. Across the nation, demonstrators took to the streets last night after the release of video of the deadly police beating of Tyre Nichols. Mostly peaceful demonstrations took place in Memphis, San Francisco, Atlanta, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Asheville, North Carolina, and Providence, Rhode Island, to name just a few. It took less than 2 weeks for the five officers involved in Tyre Nichols' death to be fired and charged. In a press conference Friday, Nichols' family attorney Benjamin Crump commended Memphis officials for acting quickly. He said their reaction time should be a model for all cases involving police brutality.
We want to proclaim that this is the blueprint going forward for any time, any officers, whether they be black or white, will be held accountable. No longer can you tell us we gotta wait 6 months to a year, even though we got a video with evidence of the excessive force and the crime.
Funeral services will be held for Tyre Nichols next week. MSNBC host and president of National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton, will deliver the eulogy. These eulogies are a ritual he says he's had to perform far too often after a black person is killed by police. The Reverend Al Sharpton joins me at the top of the hour to discuss all of this ahead of his trip to Tennessee. And then later tonight, you'll want to tune in to his show, Politics Nation, right here on MSNBC at 5 p.m. Eastern. He will sit down with the family's attorney, whom you just heard from, Benjamin Crump, as well as Tyre's mother and stepfather, Rovon Wells and Rodney Wells. We'll have more Velshi after a quick break. Officials in San Francisco have released video evidence from the night that a man broke into the home of former Speaker Nancy Pelosi and attacked her husband with a hammer. The Pelosi family, prosecutors and defense attorneys asked for the video not to be released, but a judge overruled their request. NBC's Gadi Schwartz has details, but we have to warn you that some of the video you are about to see is disturbing.
Hi. Drop the hammer.
It was a sudden attack captured on police body cam. Video showing the moment Paul Pelosi, husband of former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was knocked unconscious, struck in the head with a hammer inside his home. According to newly released case evidence, the chain of events started around 2 a.m. October 28th. Security video shows the then 42-year-old David DePap break into the Pelosi home. Minutes later, Paul Pelosi calls 911 with DePap in earshot. Cryptically trying to communicate, the intruder was looking for his wife, the Speaker of the House, without antagonizing DePap.
He thinks everything's good. I've got a problem, but he thinks everything's good.
Okay. Call us back if you change your mind.
No. This gentleman just came into the house, and he wants to wait here for my wife to come home.
Do you know who the person is?
No, I don't know who he is. He has this. He's telling me not to do anything. He's telling me to put the phone down and just do what he said. 18 seconds. Okay.
Shortly after, Pelosi tells the dispatcher DePap wants him to get the hell off the phone and is disconnected. Moments later, two officers arrive for a welfare check to find DePap and Pelosi both holding a hammer, Pelosi also holding a glass. Pelosi rushed to the hospital with a skull fracture, while DePap told investigators he broke in to interrogate Nancy Pelosi.
So, I guess, what was your intention to go there to make her change her ways?
Well, I was going to basically hold her hostage, and I was going to talk to her and basically tell her what I do.
And hold her hostage and do what?
And talk to her. If she told the truth, I'd let her go scot-free.
Right.
If she lied, that was going to break me down.
The release comes after a petition by a coalition of press organizations, including NBC News, was granted by a judge over the objections of both prosecution and defense. On Capitol Hill, Nancy Pelosi reacting to the release.
I have absolutely no intention of seeing the deadly assault on my husband's life.
As her husband continues to recover from the attack.
Thanks to Gadi Schwartz for that reporting. All right, up next, more from Memphis. NBC News has new reporting about the body cameras worn by the five officers involved in Tyre Nichols' death. All right, continuing to follow the latest out of Memphis following the release of video showing the beating of Tyre Nichols, which prosecutors allege led to his death. Now, I say that because he was beaten on January 7th. He died a couple of days later in hospital. Five police officers have been charged in his death, charged with second-degree murder. Tyre, by the way, is 29 years old, about 145 pounds, which becomes relevant when looking at the video of what happened with with cops who were all much larger than he was and heavily armed. He's a guy who liked skateboarding. He liked taking pictures of the sunsets. He loved sunsets, so he took pictures of them a lot. And he had a four-year-old son. He worked with his stepfather at FedEx. They would take their lunches together every day. They'd go home, and his mom would cook him lunch every single day. Joining me now live in Memphis is NBC News correspondent Sam Brock. Sam, you have just spoken with a member of the Memphis City Council who has he's got an idea. He's got a postulation about the body cameras.
Yeah, it's definitely more than an idea, Ali, and good morning. You know, one of the questions in all this that many of us have watching this video is what transpired prior to that first confrontation? Why did we not hear more? And as he explained it to me, the body cameras have to be activated once police officers approach a scene. They realize something is going to happen. There's 1 minute of pre-record that has no audio on it. So that's why we don't hear anything on that video for the first minute. And then they approach Tyre Nichols' car. And so as that is all going on, you'll notice part of that is coming from a body camera, but in the second confrontation, there's only two different vantage points of body cameras. There's five responding officers. And so the question becomes, where are these three other vantage points that were supposed to be provided? As it was explained to me by the council member, his name is Chase Carlisle, is that there was a meeting last night with four council members and the lead attorney for the city. And their discussion, having known that they've disclosed all the video in this, is that there's only two possibilities here, Ali. One is that three of those officers just did not activate their body cameras, or the other is that the video was lost. It's certainly relevant in the sense that the body camera footage policy in Memphis came about from a 2018 situation with a gentleman named Martavius Banks who was shot by police, and the body cameras on those officers were not activated the entire time, and it led to a new policy here. So just not turning on your body camera at all is a violation of policy, according to Mr. Carlisle. It's one of the reasons potentially that these officers were fired in the first place. But it's just trying to grapple with and understand sort of the sequencing of events, what video was available and when, but also just the sheer brutality of what we witnessed. We know that one of the attorneys for Desmond Mills talked about the fact, this is one of the officers who was fired, described him as a gentle, respectful father. What kind of father looks at someone else's son being beaten like this, right? We saw haymakers. We saw kicking on the ground as he's lying down and doesn't respond and doesn't intervene. And so these are more of the questions that are going to be wrestled with in the coming weeks. But we're working to get more information on what exactly transpired with these body cameras.
There's a question in police training about a duty to intervene, which we saw a massive failure of in Minneapolis with George Floyd. And we, again, seem to have been witnessing on this video. Sam, I've got a copy of the Memphis Police Department policy and procedures dated July 5th, 2021. So this is an updated version of the policy you were just talking about. They refer to body-worn cameras. And it says officers shall activate their body-worn cameras when responding to all calls for service prior to making the scene of a dispatched call. In the event that recording was not started prior to making the scene of a dispatched call, an officer will activate the device as soon as reasonably possible. The next point is that officers shall record all law enforcement encounters and activities. So as a matter of policy, if they all had body-worn cameras on and they were in an active situation, as they were, because they were involved with dispatch, they were calling it in, they pulled them over for what those police officers argued was reckless driving, although the police chief says there's no evidence of that. They should have the understanding is they should have all had body cameras and they should have all been on.
Of course, and you use the word reasonable there. So obviously there is a discretionary element to all of this, but the reality is you're looking at two different body cameras, and it's that poll camera, Ali, that really provides arguably the greatest context in all this as we see the group of five officers surrounding this man, Tyre Nichols, and delivering those body blows. But we only had two different body camera perspectives. So yes, the question about that third. By the way, there's another point that needs to be made here. There was a sixth responding officer who was a part of the Scorpion unit. This officer is white, and we do see his body camera as well. He is heard on that body camera. He stays behind with the abandoned vehicle per department policy. And he says something to the effect of, I hope they stomp him. Okay, this is audible on his camera. It just speaks again to the narrative of what the mentality of this unit was or was not as they approached what is allegedly a basic traffic infraction and ultimately led to a death sentence for this man.
Right, because if you've got a basic traffic infraction, but then you have the car, the driver's no longer in control of that car and he's gone, the proximate threat for which you engaged is now gone. You got the car, you'll know who it is. There are a lot of municipalities across this country, including Philadelphia, where I spend a lot of time, where they've decided they're not engaging in routine traffic things because this happens. Yeah. They become this. They escalate into things like this. Even some of those cops in those cities say, let's not do this. Let's do real policing. Let's not do this because the danger of this, what we watched in Memphis go wrong, is too great.
It's just not worth it. And yeah. Then, you know, it also necessitates a question about why were they yanking him out of this car right away? In the words of the Memphis police chief, they came in at a 10 out of 10. And if we don't have the backdrop, we don't have those conversations that occurred prior to this initial confrontation with Nichols. But they come out with guns drawn, Ali. I mean, that stands out right away in that first video. And they pull him out of the car. And Tyree Nichols is on the ground within seconds after that, saying, what did I do? I'm just trying to go home. And so this level of violence and aggression that was displayed, I have not heard an explanation for this yet.
Yep.
What could have potentially precipitated that? But we now know, other developing news, that Scorpion unit, that specialized unit right now is inactive for the time being, according to Memphis's mayor.
Sam, this is important reporting. I thank you for bringing it to us as quickly as you could. NBC's Sam Brock is in Memphis. Again, the story here is that there may have been other police. There were other police there, but we don't have video from their body worn cameras. We're trying to figure out why that is, because I've got the policy right here for the Memphis Police Department. And it says body cameras have to be worn and on when they engage in a stop. I want to bring in my friend, Reverend Al Sharpton. He's the president of the National Action Network. He's the host of Politics Nation here on MSNBC. He's going to give the eulogy at Tyree Nichols' funeral services next week, as he always does. And Rev, I appreciate it because I know it's these are all long days for you. So I always appreciate that you take time to come and talk to our audience here about it. You've heard this new news. There seems to be a great deal of inconsistency. Every one of these police killings is a little bit different, but this one was violent. This one had an energy to it. These cops came in hot, and it's just not clear. The Memphis Police Department says what they say they stopped him for, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of the reckless driving. But even if it were true, they stopped the guy. They got him out of his car. It's done. It's over. Why the beatings? Why the chasing? Why the haymakers? Why the kicks in the face?
And what was troubling as I watched the film last night, and I spoke about an hour ago with his parents and Attorney Ben Crump, is that they seemed to verbally give a narrative that was the opposite of what they were doing. They kept saying, give us your hands, when they had his arms. It was almost like they were narrating a cover-up while they were doing what became a crime. And that was troubling because, first of all, you're after someone that is not clear had committed a crime. At worst, it would have been a traffic situation. And now even the police chief is saying there's no evidence of that. But if you thought he had run a light or was speeding, once you had stopped him and grabbed him out the car,
what can't do that anymore.
After him for then?
Yep. Can't do anything after
absolutely.
That. You've taken that threat away. So why chase him? When they said, when that cop says, I hope they get him, why? You've got his car. You know who he is. It's 2023. We will find him. You can arrest him. You can do whatever you want later. And yet so many municipalities, in part thanks to some of the work you've done, have decided, as Sam Brock just said, it's not worth it to possibly end up with someone dead over a traffic infraction.
And over something that we don't even know if it was a traffic infraction.
Right.
If it was something even worse, you don't beat a man to death. Five men on a 140-pound thin young man, unarmed. Five men. I mean, you or I could have probably handcuffed him. So what is this power trip? What is this venom that we allow police to put on private citizens and then talking to the camera like if there's some kind of threat? I've seen many things over the years I've been out here. This is among, if not the worst I've seen. I remember 32 years ago, I led marches around Rodney King. This is worse than Rodney King. And the fact that they were black makes it even more egregious to me. We fought to get blacks on the police force, and for them to behave in this way is inexcusable, which is why we're going to stay with this family and demand justice and policy and legal change.
Professor Jelani Cobb of the Columbia Journalism School was with me last night. He's obviously, as you know, studied this a great deal. And he says the studies indicate that when you integrate police forces, which is something you have been calling for and others have been calling for decades and has been done in some cases, it only marginally reduces the likelihood of violence against black people. And he said that with some surprise, that why is it only marginal? Why is it that black police don't see black people who they treat as somebody sort of who's like them and worthy of empathy? Captain Sonia Pruitt from Maryland told me the same thing this morning, that often that's not how it's regarded.
They become two answers, I believe. One, they become part of the police culture and that they feel that they become the law unto themselves. And secondly, there is no legislation that makes them feel that they have anything at risk, which is why I've said that we must intensify passing the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. Qualified immunity makes a policeman feel that unless I'm caught, which is very rare, unless there's some criminal charges, I'm not at risk. My house, my car won't be taken. My family will be fine. We must make federal law where we make it clear that you have skin in the game when you do the kinds of things that you've done in this case of Tyre Nichols.
And to be clear, qualified immunity means that those police cannot be sued by the families. They cannot be sued for the work they do in the course of their policing, even if determined that that policing was bad policing. And that's part of the problem we've got. Now, on one hand, that's true. On the other hand, Attorney Crump, who you spoke to this morning, and the Nichols family, Tyre Nichols family, has said they wanted first-degree murder charges, but they're not dissatisfied with the idea that there are second-degree murder charges. However, as you know, trials are long and complicated, and even things that look like slam dunks are not when it comes to police.
I warn people, and I'll be doing this in the eulogy, that this is going to be a long road, and they're going to try to separate these trials. They're going to prolong them so that the media is gone. One of the reasons that families engage with groups like National Action Network, our group, is we're there for the long run. I spent time last night talking to Philonis Floyd and people that I've felt with for 30 years ago to bring them to Memphis because they understand the pain of this family. The spotlight will be gone in 2 or 3 days. You know that, Ali, as well as I do. They're going to have to deal with this, and that's why we need to stand by them and with them. And we need to make sure that Tyre did not die in vain. Let's have federal law named after him and George Floyd. Let's change the legal options these policemen have. We cannot say we can change their heart, but we can certainly change how they operate their hands.
We came really close to getting that done after George Floyd's death, and that was a video that ricocheted around the world. Does this get us closer? Does the Tyre Nichols not dying in vain mean that maybe a few extra people will say, because that's all we needed really in Washington, just a few extra people to vote in favor of this in the Senate and pass a fairly reasonable law that would create greater accountability for police?
I think this could bring us closer. We have only a need for a few more, and we have people looking at 2024. The politics may change. I do not know if it will, but we're going to make every effort we can. You know, it's interesting to me when I study the generation ahead of me of civil rights activists. They didn't know what particular incident would trigger them getting the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Civil Voting Rights Act of 65. Just they kept going until they got it. And that's what we're going to do. This may be the one. It may not be the one, but it won't be because we didn't press it with all we have.
Rev, thanks for being with us again this morning. The Reverend Al Sharpton is the president of the National Action Network. Tune into Politics Nation on MSNBC today at 5 p.m. The Rev's going to be sitting down with the family's attorney, Benjamin Crump, as well as with Tyre Nichols' mother and stepfather, Rovon and Rodney Wells. We're going to continue to cover this story. And, of course, the Rev will be eulogizing Tyre Nichols at his funeral this week. We're going to be heading back to Memphis later this hour. We'll continue to follow the story of the investigation and the fallout of the release of the police body cam footage. And by the way, whether there is now missing body cam footage, because there's some speculation that we don't have everything that we should have had. This is the story of the beating of Tyre Nichols, which led to his death. More Bell Sheena. Turning now to Israel and the West Bank, where the latest round of violence threatens to plunge the region into a bloody conflict. A 13-year-old Palestinian opened fire in East Jerusalem today, wounding at least two people, less than a day after another gunman killed seven people outside a synagogue in Jerusalem. Friday's gunman was killed in a shootout with police shortly after the shooting. Israeli police say today's shooter was shot and apprehended. The Washington Post is reporting that Israeli forces arrested 42 people in East Jerusalem as Israeli security forces fanned out across the West Bank. On Friday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, yeah, he's back, announced that he's outlined immediate actions in response to the deadly shooting. Israeli forces are operating under the highest alert level and have deployed an additional military battalion to the West Bank today. Friday's shooting comes just one day after Israel's single deadliest operation in the West Bank in two decades, according to Israel human rights group B'Tselem. Nine Palestinians were killed on Thursday when the Israeli military raided a refugee camp in the West Bank city of Jenin. Israel says the raid was aimed at thwarting an attack against Israeli soldiers. Now, this brings the total number of Palestinians killed in less than a month to 30, according to the New York Times. Demonstrations erupted across the West Bank following Thursday's deadly raid, and Israeli forces killed a 22-year-old Palestinian later in the day during a protest north of Jerusalem. Now, in response to that raid, the Palestinian Authority announced that it was immediately suspending security coordination with Israel that is aimed at containing militants. And that's a move that threatens to escalate an already volatile situation following the recent election of Israel's ultra-nationalist government, the most right-wing government in the country's history. Meanwhile, Gaza militants fired rockets and Israel carried out airstrikes early Friday morning as tensions in the region continue to soar. This latest flare-up comes just days ahead of Secretary of State Antony Blinken's planned trip to the region this weekend. He's going to meet separately with Israeli and Palestinian leadership. A lot has been going on there with more on this rapidly escalating situation. I'm joined by NBC News foreign correspondent Molly Hunter, who's been covering the story for a very, very long time. Molly, it's just one of those things that feels different. I think a lot of viewers will say this kind of happens all the time, but not at this level and velocity and intensity.
Yeah, Ali, it feels different. It feels like there is a spark for a possible real escalation. And certainly Secretary of State Blinken's trip, he arrives in the region tomorrow, couldn't be coming at a more important time. We do understand that he'll meet with Israeli officials. He'll meet with Palestinian officials. Now, Ali, we both spent a lot of time there. Look, I've spent a lot of time in Jenin, in this refugee camp that you were just mentioning in your intro. It is the place of the Israeli raid that happened on Thursday. Just to give our viewers a little bit of context, it's in the north of the occupied West Bank. It is one of the poorest areas. And there are regular raids. This happens a lot. They're usually at night, Ali. This was a rare daytime raid, which is why a shootout ensued, which is why that death toll, we understand nine people were killed, including an elderly woman, also including seven militants, was so high. And why that really kind of sparked rage. Now, what's interesting, Ali, and what we're talking to, obviously, our very strong team on the ground, Lawahaz Jabri, one of our producers there, we're really talking about what we're not seeing, though, what ingredients are possibly missing. So the gunman from yesterday's shooting at the synagogue in a settlement in East Jerusalem. The gunman today, Ali, neither of those men have affiliations or connections to either Hamas or the Islamic Jihad. And when we saw that rocket fire coming from Gaza overnight after that Israeli raid in Jenin, it was not coming from the Islamic Jihad or from Hamas. So as we are watching the next 24 hours, Ali, and really it is rapidly escalating, we are watching minute by minute, hour by hour, we are going to watch if either the Islamic Jihad or if Hamas kind of says anything, if they take any real action, if they escalate this. Now, what is interesting in Jerusalem, we are seeing protests. We are seeing clashes happening in some of those East Jerusalem neighborhoods reacting to what has been happening in the last 24 hours. So with Israeli security at such a high alert, they say they're at the highest alert ever, with Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing government obviously threatening to really escalate this, we could see the situation rapidly change in the next 24 hours, Ali.
Molly, this is an interesting point that you make. Benjamin Netanyahu is back. And I think there are some people who missed this idea that he's back. He, in order to create this coalition that has made him prime minister again, the Israeli politics has just moved further and further right over the years. They're now sending a battalion into the West Bank. So this escalation is real. It's not just rhetorical. Often you'll hear Palestinians say something. You'll hear the Israeli government say something. But the Palestinians are saying they're curtailing their security cooperation with Israel, which is actually quite functional, and it's why a lot of young Palestinians are mad. And Benjamin Netanyahu says he's taking real action. He's sending more armed troops into the West Bank.
Yeah, and he says that that is not all that is going to be done. He says he will have a full plan to react to the events, to the deadly few days. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu, to form this government, as you mentioned, packed his government full of ultra-nationalists who are pushing for a very hard line against Palestinian violence, Ali. And look, it was a busy year in international news in 2022. Yeah. We didn't focus as much as I think we have in the past on this area. It was the deadliest year for Palestinians that we have seen in nearly two decades, Ali. There were flare-ups. We certainly didn't see a full-out conflict, but it has really been priming. It has been greasing the runway. When we look at the start of this year, as you mentioned, that number, at least 30 Palestinians have been killed just this month. Now, the Israelis say most of those are militants, but we do know that innocent civilians get caught in those raids, like we saw on Thursday in Jenin. A 61-year-old woman who was not a militant was killed. The Israelis say they are looking into that. But we do know that as a battalion, for example, goes into the West Bank, as they enforce those troops, that there will be civilians who are caught in this, in addition to the militants that we saw, for example, take up arms in Jenin. Ali, really important also, just additional context on Jenin. It is one of the only places in the occupied West Bank that you will see Palestinian militants with guns. That is why there was actually a shootout. That is why they were able to return fire. And that is why that death toll was pretty high.
Molly, we are grateful for your experience and your expertise on this volatile topic. Thank you for being with us. Molly Hunter, live from London. Still ahead, the new U.S. ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy, has arrived in Moscow, the first ever woman to hold the position, and at a time when Russian relations between the U.S. and Russia are at a low that has not been seen since the Cold War. You're watching Belshi. You probably know John Quincy Adams as America's sixth president, also the son of John Adams, the second president. But John Quincy Adams also made history as America's first recognized ambassador, or minister, as it was then known, to the Russian Empire. Flash forward to Thursday when Lynn M. Tracy assumed her post in Moscow as U.S. ambassador to the Russian Federation, the first woman to hold that prestigious and perilous position. It comes as relations between Russia and the U.S. continue to sink to depths not seen since the Soviet Union era, spurred by Russia's barbaric war in Ukraine, which is now in day 339. Following much consternation, Germany now plans to send 14 sophisticated Leopard 2 main battle tanks, these things you're looking at, to Ukraine, while also authorizing other European nations to whom Germany has sold those tanks to send up to 88 more of them. The United States is sending 31 of the advanced Abrams M1 tanks. At the same time, a report in Russian state media says Russia's getting some more tanks. It's acquired 30 T-34 tanks from Laos, which the Soviet Union produced in 1944. It's 2023. They're getting tanks that were built in 1944. Laos reportedly received them as a gift from Vietnam in the 1980s, and they're regifting them to Russia. Both the Leopard and the Abrams tanks, which are real modern battle tanks, will make a major difference on the battlefield, although they won't be put into battle for several more months. There's just a lot of logistics involved in getting them there, training people in how to use them, and parts and repair. But following the tank announcement, Russia launched another major barrage of missile and self-destructing drone strikes in areas including the capital, Kyiv, Zaporizhia, and Odessa. Ukrainian officials say at least 11 people died. The strikes are a continuation of Russia's strategy of targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure far from the front of the war, trying to terrorize the Ukrainian citizenry into submission. It is a strategy that continues not to work. Joining me now is the retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He's the former director of European Affairs on the National Security Council. He's the author of an extremely important book, Here Right Matters, An American Story, which, by the way, has a lot of Ukrainian and Russian history in it, so it's important to read. Colonel, good to see you. Thank you for being with us, sir. You told me, I'm trying to think about when it was, but it was somewhere around a year ago. You said, in the end, the unthinkable will become the thing that we do in Ukraine. Everything that Ukraine asks for that we don't do, we will do, and more. And in the last 3 weeks, you and I have talked about this, and we discussed not prosecuting this war 6 weeks at a time, and NATO just deciding what it's capable of doing and doing it. And a lot of that has happened. These battle tanks, the armaments that were announced last week, it's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, actually, I think this week, this past week, I may have ribbed key members of this administration, telling them that I'm increasingly confident that we will ultimately transfer long-range fires, We'll transfer planes. We'll transfer everything else that's on the demand list or on the request list from Ukraine that we still haven't delivered because of our reluctance to fully support Ukraine. So I thought that, you know, a year into this war is appropriate to kind of remind them of the fact that everything they said was that was a red line we've blown past. And even now, there is still reluctance to provide air power, which the Ukrainians can absorb eventually, these tanks much more quickly, long range fires, amongst other capabilities, drones that we don't often talk about. We're going to get there. This administration is still deeply reluctant for multiple different reasons, one of which is Ukraine winning too much, Russia losing too badly, and what that means for Russian stability. We still haven't gotten past some of these major obstacles, kind of mental blocks for this administration, I think.
Tell me about what that means, Russia, Ukraine winning too much and Russia losing too badly. Because I think for people who don't study war, they'd say going back to what was before the war or before the invasion of Crimea seems normal, right? Ukraine getting its land back, Russia going back to Russia and everybody living peacefully. Ukraine will then become a NATO country over time and this won't happen again. What does winning too much and losing too badly mean and why is it a problem?
Well, it's mainly a problem, not because it's not an issue for the Ukrainians and liberating their territory. It's the fact that Russia is a nuclear power and there are fears, misplaced fears, that in the final phase of this war, when Crimea is threatened, that Putin could lash out and that's a recipe for escalation. I think that is the most dangerous point of this war. And it's likely to be, you know, late summer, the fall, deep into this year. And it didn't have to be this late. Things, frankly, Putin could have come to the recognition that he didn't have the military means to achieve his political aims early on, before he really kind of had the chance to ruminate on the use of nuclear weapons or take incremental steps to using nuclear weapons. But that's the big issue in the kind of most acute phase towards the end of this year is whether Russia uses nukes. The other one, and they're not going to do it. I need to kind of stamp my foot on that one. Putin is not going to manifest the one thing that he's most concerned about, which is ending his regime in the use of nuclear weapons. There's a real risk of that. Whereas, you know, tucking tail and going home, he could live to fight another day. He's not threatened. He could still suppress his population. He still actually is quite popular. The other aspect of this is what happens to Russia internally? What happens if Putin is on the outs and he gets replaced by, you know, another kind of madman like Prigozhin that sometimes gets talked about? I don't think he's likely a contender for replacement, but, you know, there are more radical candidates. What happens if there's internal civil war in Russia and the North Caucasus break off? What happens if, you know, there's a loose nuke scenario? This is the same thing I've been writing about for, you know, quite some time. It's part of my dissertation, actually. And these are the fears, again, frankly, from folks that don't necessarily understand the topic as well as they should to be able to make the decisions that they're making now, that drives their decision making and arrests their ability to lean in and support Ukraine and help bring this war to a rapid conclusion.
That's why we have you on here, because you're a guy who actually does know all of these things, and you have been writing, and I encourage our viewers to read your writing on this because it's very sophisticated. Thank you, as always. The retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman is a former director for European Affairs at the National Security Council and the author of Here, Right Matters, An American Story. I implore you to read this book. It's an easy read, and you will know a lot about Russia and Ukraine and Alexander Vindman after reading it. Right after the break, we're back in Memphis, Tennessee, a city that's reeling from the brutal murder of Tyre Nichols. You're watching the Following yesterday's release of body cam footage showing the brutal beating of Tyre Nichols, demonstrations have cropped up across the country. Shortly after the footage was made public last night, demonstrators in Memphis shut down the I-55 bridge, which is a major highway. For more on the reaction on the ground, we're joined by NBC News national reporter Dion Hampton, this reporting from Memphis this morning. Dion, usually you and I are together in these things, and while I'm reporting the sort of the developments from officials and things that are happening, you are out there talking to people about what they're feeling. And the feels were very big in Memphis last night. The idea that this video was out there, people were processing it. There were four different videos. What's the mood and tone, and what have you been hearing?
I mean, just before when you went to commercial break, there was a car that just drove by and said justice for Tyree just a few minutes ago. And I think that's the mood and the feeling of what a lot of people in Memphis are feeling right now. They want justice. So there was about 400 people who clogged and stopped traffic on Interstate 55 last night in both directions. I think what was most surprising to me was that it was a very peaceful protest. I mean, I didn't see anybody get arrested. I didn't see any type of vandalism, which is actually pretty good because you don't want those type of things to happen in these type of situations. You know, I remember when I was in Cincinnati, when there was George Floyd protest there, you know, it was early in the morning and looters and vandals, they broke into a record number of stores in downtown Cincinnati. You saw none of that last night. And I think that's for several reasons. One is because I think the city of Memphis and the police department did a very good job of being transparent with the public about what was going on. Even though we hadn't saw any of the videos yet, we kind of knew from the quotes from the lawyers about this kind of resembled the Rodney King beating. We saw the police chief saying that this was a heinous beating. So some of that was kind of already baked into the public. We knew it was bad. We just hadn't seen the video yet. And then also because the police department and city officials acted so swiftly going after the five police officers. You saw that they were fired. You saw that they were accused and then later charged with second-degree murder charges. So because of that, you ended up seeing a lot of peaceful protests last night where these hundreds of protesters ended up stalling the traffic on Interstate 55 for about 4 hours.
Dion, what's the sense? You said that the police have been transparent. We were talking to Antonia about that this morning. They've come out again. They warned people. Right. They used the language that people who are watching this would say. It was heinous. It was remarkably violent. At the same time, the family seems satisfied with the charges that have been laid. But justice for Tyree means
right.
means an actual trial and an actual conviction. You and I talked about this in Minneapolis. There's a long way between where we are today and conviction on the serious charges that these police face.
Right. And this is kind of like the blueprint going forward, in my opinion, as far as like maybe how cities should go after these type of situations, because in a lot of different cases, you know, it takes forever to get charges brought up, or it takes forever for the city officials to respond or for to give results from like the investigation. But that didn't happen in this case. I mean, within a week of this becoming really national news and becoming public, there were charges against these officers, which I think, you know, going forward, that's what a lot of different departments and a lot of different cities need to look at to kind of, because a lot of times what happens is that it's the shock factor. It's all of a sudden out the blue, you see the video and nobody really had a chance to like brace for what was coming. But everybody had a chance to like prepare in anticipation for what was coming last night. And I think that's why they got the positive results from the protest last night.
Dion, thanks again for joining us. As always, NBC's Dion Hampton is live in Memphis. All right, today's meeting of the Velshi Band Book Club is nearly in session. Author David Levithan is going to join me in the studio to discuss his poignant young adult novel, Two Boys Kissing. The book deals with heavy subject matter, narrated by a chorus of men who died of AIDS. But it is notably optimistic, sweet, and believe it or not, even light. Don't miss this important conversation when we come back. Harry and Craig have an idea. They're going to protest a recent homophobic incident by kissing for 32 hours, 12 minutes, and 10 seconds until they've broken the world record. And they're going to do it in front of their entire high school, their families, and rolling cameras. It's an act that's both political and personal. Harry and Craig's story is just one of four separate narratives that weave together to create David Levithan's Two Boys Kissing. The award-winning young adult novel is today's Velshi Band Book Club feature. Two Boys Kissing is one of those skillfully written novels where the plot is not fully indicative of the story actually being told. The novel grapples with freedom, equality, intergenerational mobility, and community through a tender coming-of-age lens. The reader is not alone in observing the impact of that titular kiss. The book employs the use of a literary device, a Greek chorus. The ghosts of a generation of gay men who died in the AIDS epidemic function as an omnipresent collective narrator. We meet them first before any other character on the first page. Quote, we are the spirit burden you carry, like that of your grandparents or the friends from your childhood who at some point moved away. We try to make it as light a burden as possible. We were once the ones who were living, and then we were the ones who were dying, end quote. Based on true events, Two Boys Kissing explores that all too real burden. One of hatred, rejection, and blatant homophobia, but just as the chorus says, manages to keep it light. Even in the face of tragedy, the book is characterized by its optimism and its compassion. The future is undoubtedly brighter in the world that Harry and Craig and Ryan and Avery and Peter and Neil and Cooper live in. Two Boys Kissing has been frequently challenged for ban, topping the American Literary Association's top 10 list 3 times in 2015, 2016, and 2018. As you know, we've covered many books that explore the LGBTQ experience and coming-of-age journey on the Velshi Band Book Club, but never have we featured a book that has been targeted for ban because of its cover alone. In 2014, the parents of a child at one high school in Virginia argued that the cover imagery on the book violated the school's rules against public displays of affection. Why do schools have rules against public displays of affection in the first place? But that's another topic. She did eventually open the cover of the book long enough to count the profanities. 10 uses of a profane word that starts with F and rhymes with duck. A recent graduate who identified himself as a member of the LGBTQ plus community responded to the call for removal by describing the power of Two Boys Kissing and other similar books in a letter to the school board, writing in part, quote, the books were very poignant to me. My librarians helped me to broaden my horizons. I didn't have to sit around and think that I was so alone in this school. I have to reference the imagery of the chorus in Two Boys Kissing once again, because that boy from that Virginia high school, like the boys in Two Boys Kissing, is not alone. Even if he has yet to find a community, even if he has yet, if he's felt ostracized or shamed or hated, he's got authors. He's got fictional characters. We've seen it again and again. Books can save a life. Right after the break, I'm thrilled to be joined by David Levithan. He's the award-winning author of numerous novels, including Two Boys Kissing. I am thrilled to be joined by David Levithan. He's the author of numerous award-winning books, including today's Velshi Band Book Club feature, Two Boys Kissing. David, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me here.
This is a great book, and it's based on a true story. When you get challenged, when somebody wants to ban this book or have it removed from a library, does it matter that it's based on a true story or not in this case?
I mean, I don't think it is. I mean, I think my book hits the list because it's called Two Boys Kissing. It shows two boys kissing on the cover. It contains more than two boys kissing inside. And so, yes, historical record, the fact that it is based on intergenerational and a generation of men who died from AIDS looking down at the current generation, none of those subtleties matter. They just object to two boys kissing.
I was mentioning in the introduction that it's optimistic and has a lightness mm-hmm. to it that you wouldn't expect based on the description of the book that I gave. If you were writing the book today, would you be as optimistic in the way it was written?
I think I'd even be more optimistic, because I think one of the things the older generation in the book realizes is that the younger generation has their act together more and is going to experience more freedoms than they ever imagined. And even though adults are trying to get in the way of what they do and what they read and who they kiss, that they will still triumph. And I believe that with every ounce of my heart.
We talked about the Greek chorus. Yeah. It's prevalent. You hear from the Greek chorus before you hear from any of the other characters in the book, starting in the introduction. Tell me about that as a literary device and why you chose it.
I mean, when looking at my books, I was startled that I had not engaged yet in sort of the older generation. My uncle lived with AIDS for over 35 years, and I was obviously exposed to him and his friends and what they went through. And I really liked the idea of what their generation would see when they saw the generation below mine, so the internet generation, and honoring them. And part of the lightness of the tone is because that's how they lived life, that it wasn't all seriousness. It was defiance and humor as well as struggle.
But the struggle's different today, right?
Yes.
Something has morphed. It has become once again central because of bans, because of so-called culture wars. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, students who struggle with this, readers who struggle with this, as we've said on this show previous times, it can save lives. People can say they're not alone. On the other, they are more targeted in school environments than perhaps we've seen in the last couple of decades.
Yeah, the conflict has turned from an internal to an external one. That it used to be that you would doubt yourself and doubt who you are. But now I think the younger generation, they do understand who they are more. But there are adults who are resisting it. And that's what we see with these book challenges and with this legislation that's happening.
At one point in the book, Tariq gives his friends a bust of Walt Whitman and reads the poem, "We Two Boys Together Clinging." We Two Boys, is that tied to the title? Is that where the title comes from?
Absolutely. It's actually what I love about the intergenerationality of the book is that the Walt Whitman poem inspired a David Hockney painting that I saw in an exhibit at DC when I was down there for my best friend's wedding. And just seeing that and saying, oh, well, this is, we learn from each other and we build on each other. That's what this is all about. And what I do in writing Two Boys Kissing, there are already kids who read Two Boys Kissing when they were a teenager who are writing novels and creating art themselves inspired by it. And that is how we grow and that is how we get changed.
Were you surprised at challenges to the book or not? I mean, did you write it and design that cover to be provocative?
I mean, my first book was called Boy Meets Boy, so I knew I was getting into
it
by calling
evolution.
A book, yeah, Two Boys Kissing. No, I knew that there would be resistance. But I wanted it would be easy to sort of try to hide it away, call the book something else and let people find it secretly. But I loved the power of a kid walks into a library or a school, sees that book on the shelf, and they know they're represented. They know exactly.
So you're a member of a team of writers now where books get challenged.
Yeah.
Should that team grow? In other words, is it good for the literary world that books are written and get challenged? Because there are viewers of mine, and there are bookstores all through New York where you walk by, and there's a banned book section, and people just buy those books to say, hey, what'd you ban that for? I want to read it.
Right. No, please support them. What's amazing is when I started, Boy Meets Boy was published 20 years ago. If you had censorship panels, there were basically the same six authors who were always on them. Now there are so many authors being challenged. I mean, the Pen says that in the last year of challenges, 1,800 authors and illustrators had their books challenged. 1,800. I see that figure, and I'm not afraid of the challenges. What I am is I'm proud of publishing. I'm proud that we have that many authors writing books that people are afraid of and writing that many about that many identities that people want to try to silence. But 1,800 authors, you're not going to silence us easily.
So are people less tolerant, or are we writing more books that challenge people?
We're writing more books that challenge people, and I think there is a politicization of it that was not there even 5 years ago, that now we are in the eye of that storm where it has become political, and people who otherwise don't really care, they see that they can gain power by attacking us, and so they're just doing it for their political motives.
You work for Scholastic, a publishing company, in addition to being an author. In October, we featured the book Melissa by Alex Gino, one of our fantastic interviews. You actually acquired and edited that book.
I did, quite proudly. And again, it's just amazing because Alex was speaking for readers that had not heard their voices in that age level literature before.
Okay, Alex is queer and transgender, and that's just not all that clear. It's not that clear how you're going to find books like that if you identify the way Alex does.
Right. No, you have to, again, our literature evolves very quickly. And 10 years ago, there were some voices that weren't on the shelves. And so we as publishers and as editors, we have to find those voices and we have to empower voices like Alex's to write the stories that are true to their heart. And that's exactly what Alex keeps doing. And it resonates.
That's amazing. You're writing books that are getting challenged and banned, and you're involved in the acquisition and publishing of books.
Yeah, we're all on the same team. Yes.
You are a walking, talking, banned book guy. David, thank you. I appreciate the book, and I appreciate you coming in here to talk to us about it.
Thanks so much.
David Levithan is the author of Two Boys Kissing. If you can believe it, it's been a year since we started the Velshi Band Book Club. 1 year of author interviews, close reads, poignant texts, and resisting through reading. Next weekend, we're taking it all back to the beginning with Nicole Hannah-Jones, the author of The 1619 Project, which is a crucial book that is reframing the way our nation views slavery and, as a result, its very history. Of course, it's been targeted for relentless ban. It's the thing that we started with. We talked to her first about this. Nicole Hannah-Jones and her work inspired the Velshi Band Book Club, so it's only fitting that we get her back on our anniversary. Do not miss this very special meeting of the Velshi Band Book Club, Saturday, February the 4th at 9:45 a.m. Eastern. Write to me and tell me what you want differently in the book club. My story at Velshi.com. I would like membership cards and maybe a mug or something like that. But we're going to evolve this thing over the course of the next year. That does it for me. Thanks for watching. Catch me back here tomorrow morning from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Velshi. Don't forget, Velshi is available as a podcast. You can listen to the entire show on the go at any time. I wear that vest when I do the podcast, by the way. Subscribe and listen for free wherever you get your podcasts.